For WMRA News, I'm Bob Levicky. Harrisonburg's mayor, the Democratic challenger to Ben Klein, and Republican Nick Freitas are all given a pass on late filings and will be on the ballot this November. JMU removes the names of Confederate leaders from three campus buildings. And as Confederate statues come down in Richmond and all over the place, what should replace them? This is the WMRA Daily for Wednesday, July 8th. The Board of Visitors at James Madison University unanimously voted to remove names of Confederate leaders from campus buildings. On Monday, at their virtual meeting, the board decided the names would be removed immediately. Temporary names will be given to Maury, Jackson, and Ashby Halls during this school year as new names are selected. But JMU President Jonathan Alger said that changing the name of the university itself is not under consideration. Full disclosure, JMU's Board of Visitors holds WMRA's operating license. Harrisonburg Mayor Dena Reed, Republican Nick Freitas, and the Democratic challenger to Representative Ben Klein will all be on the ballot this November despite filing late paperwork. The Board of Elections granted a pass Tuesday to Reed and eight congressional candidates after they missed filing deadlines for paperwork. The candidates asked for the extension after missing a June 9th filing deadline. Board Chair Bob Brink reluctantly cast a tie-breaking vote to give the candidates more time.
As the process is structured right now, we're forced to give a pass to the scofflaw at the expense of the candidate who followed the rules.
Brink said the only other option, denying the candidates a place on the ballot, was too harsh. This was the second election in a row that former delegate Nick Freitas missed a filing deadline. Freitas is challenging 7th District Representative Abigail Spanberger in November. Among the congressional candidates, seven Republicans and one Democrat were given reprieves. The Democrat is Nicholas Betts, who is challenging Representative Ben Klein in the 6th District. Evictions have resumed in Virginia, but some properties are still technically protected by a federal moratorium put in place under the CARES Act. Yasmin Juma from Partner Station VPM reports.
The eviction moratorium covers residents of subsidized and public housing and properties with federally backed loans. Until July 25th, landlords of these properties can't charge tenants late fees or take any eviction actions against them for non-payment of rent. New data from the RVA Eviction Lab shows more than 1,000 eviction filings in Richmond, Henrico, and Chesterfield courts fall under these federal protections, and about 130 of them were filed after the CARES Act moratorium went into effect. Ben Teresa is with the Eviction Lab.
If people are in covered properties and they have an eviction filing, the question then becomes, how is this going to be enforced in the courts?
Legal aid attorneys say that varies. Chesterfield County General District Court requires landlords to submit a statement attesting to whether or not their property is covered. But in Richmond, a tenant would have to raise the issue in court for it to be considered.
Yasmin Juma reporting. Tenants have 10 days to appeal an eviction judgment once it's granted. Advocates with the Virginia Poverty Law Center urge anyone who thinks they're facing an unlawful eviction to get in touch with the center's eviction helpline at 833-NO-EVICT. Housing advocates in Virginia are celebrating landmark anti-discrimination laws that took effect last week. One prohibits landlords from turning away renters based on their sexual orientation or gender identity. And another could help deconcentrate poverty and racial segregation. Virginia Public Radio's Kat Modlin Jackson reports.
Until this month, landlords could turn away would-be tenants for using money from Social Security, child support, or rental assistance to pay their bills. As of July 1st, that is no longer legal for property managers or owners with more than four units in Virginia. And yet, for those who use supports like housing choice vouchers, also known as Section 8, sometimes there's more to income discrimination than dollars and cents. Alex Guzman, director of fair housing at Housing Opportunities Made Equal Virginia, explains.
Whether or not a housing provider accepts a housing choice voucher impacts generally whether or not they are denying people on the basis of race.
Guzman's colleague, Tanika Jones, helps voucher holders find homes in so-called high-opportunity neighborhoods.
Places where they're good schools, low poverty rates, transportation, different things like that.
For a lot of her clients, many of whom are Black women with children, those areas are often inaccessible. Every case is different, she says, but most have encountered landlords who wouldn't accept federal housing assistance. I spoke with voucher holders who say they've also come up against this, but none felt comfortable going public with their story. Jones thinks she knows why.
It's a lot of shame associated with it. I think that people have associated voucher holders with bad or negative views just over time.
A 2018 study from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities found that source of income laws can make it easier for people who use vouchers to move into neighborhoods with more resources. But in order to be effective, they have to carry strong enforcement mechanisms. In Virginia, housing discrimination claims rarely make it to court, Guzman explains. And when they do, they seldom resolve systemic issues.
You are addressing an individual act one at a time. It's like playing a game of whack-a-mole.
Sarah Pratt is a civil rights lawyer and a former fair housing enforcement official at the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. She explains that education for housing advocates and providers is also key to making sure everyone follows the rules.
All of them should take the time to become aware of this provision and look for resources to understand, one, what they need to do, and two, landlords should be talking to the Section 8 programs at their agencies.
Educating landlords who qualify under the law is something Patrick McLeod has spent a lot of time on lately. McLeod is CEO of the Virginia Apartment Management Association, which lobbied against the new regulations. He says he's not opposed to working with people who receive housing assistance, but he doesn't like being forced into a three-way contract with both a tenant and their voucher administrator.
If there was an easy way to explain this process, you would have never seen the industry objecting to source of funds as a protected class.
As for Tanika Jones, she's hopeful that the source of income protections will make a difference for the people she helps.
And if you just give them a chance, I think that most of them will surprise you and come out on the other end better for it.
It's a step in the right direction, she says, but there's still work to do. In Richmond, I'm Kat Maudlin Jackson.
The pandemic is likely to have an adverse effect on the count of Virginia's population during this year's census. Virginia Public Radio's Michael Pope reports.
College towns like Charlottesville, Harrisonburg, and Blacksburg are likely to take a hit during this year's census, says Spencer Shanholz at the University of Virginia's Weldon Cooper Center for Public Service.
Most colleges went online, and those students, many of them went back to their home communities, and therefore they were not necessarily counted where they would normally have been on April 1st.
College students aren't the only people at risk of being undercounted. Maya Castillo at New Virginia Majority says African-American and Hispanic neighborhoods are also likely to be distrustful of people walking around with badges and clipboards.
For a lot of different reasons, people don't necessarily trust the government. Official paperwork may go unanswered. People aren't exactly excited to get a knock on their door by someone with an official government badge.
The pandemic census is likely to have long-lasting implications. Rural communities with hard-to-reach populations and less internet access might lose out on federal funding. And college towns that don't have students this year might lose clout when new districts are drawn for the House of Delegates and the state Senate. I'm Michael Pope.
The city of Roanoke will remove a memorial marker to Confederate General Robert E. Lee. The Roanoke Times reports that the city council on Monday unanimously approved a resolution to remove the 60-year-old granite shaft from a downtown plaza. The memorial has stood in the city since 1960. It was dedicated by a Roanoke chapter of the United Daughters of the Confederacy. City officials are working under a new state law that took effect this month and gives local governments the ability to remove war memorial statues and markers. Confederate monuments have been coming down throughout the South in the wake of the police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. And as the Confederate statues in Richmond come down, another conversation is taking place about what should happen to the spaces where the monuments stood. Finally today, here's Pam Hervey with VPM in Richmond reporting.
As a young African-American artist in Richmond, Austin Miles knew her future was creating public art.
I personally fell in love with the impact. You know, on the first few projects that I was working on, and I felt like, oh, well, I can make a difference with this. I can help people see themselves, provide representation, and again, facilitate that conversation. And so I really fell in love with that.
In cities and towns across America, public art exists in many forms. Murals, sculptures, light displays are just some examples, and is often funded by the local government or public-private partnerships. According to Valerie Cassell Oliver, a curator at the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts, public art is vital to a community and is meant to create conversation.
It is literally art in the public domain. So it is a space where beautification can happen, where people can have a quality of life by just having a beautiful surroundings. But public art also is there to tell stories. It's also there to signal information. Oftentimes, public art takes the form of statues, monuments, but it also can just be artists' work, which is non-figurative, out in the public domain.
And there is power in public art, according to Colombian artist Alfonso Perez. It can express ideology and point of view. Perez feels strongly that public art must be created with community input or risk dividing the public it serves.
Sometimes when you rapidly place public art piece or a public artist to make an intervention before letting people speak, it becomes the same oppressive exercise from a different angle.
For more than a century, the Confederate monuments of Richmond loomed over the city's residents and visitors, and for many, they served as a painful reminder of racism and white supremacy. But the spaces around the monuments were nearly always empty. The demonstrations against police brutality and for racial justice transform those spaces. Brightly colored graffiti covers the monument's bases. At the Lee statue, renamed Marcus David Peters Circle by the people, there are nightly light projections that started with images of George Floyd, Frederick Douglass, and Maggie Walker, and now include performances by Black musicians like Billie Holiday and Nina Simone. Countless people have contributed to changing the space in an effort to tell a different story to the public.
I think it's important for those voices of passion, of anger, of hurt, and some versions, love for the ones that they've lost, you know? And I think it's important for those voices to not be stifled and be hid away.
Austin Miles says the people activated the spaces with art and a sense of unity.
I think there's something very special about this space that once was stark. It was a place where nobody set foot on the grass, and now it's a place for communion. And I think there's something really important about that, and I think as we move forward as a city, we should hold on to the community aspect of what's happening naturally around these spaces.
What will become of these spaces after the statues are removed? While the city hasn't announced a formal discussion of their future, Perez says it's an invitation for a different conversation, and one that's inclusive.
I think it's a natural process if you let people speak in any creative language that they want, with spray paint or with dancing or photography or candles or anything, and adapt that those voices to the city in a more sustainable and in a more like cohesive way.
That's Pam Hervey with VPM reporting. For WMRA News, I'm Bob Levicky. Thanks for listening. Stay safely connected and enjoy your Wednesday.